Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 203 of CJ Evolution. Patrick here, I'm the host and creator of the show. Whatever you were doing, wherever you were at, thank you for tuning in. Special thanks to all those first responders out there and other people working in the criminal justice field, brave men and women who put it all on the line every day. We salute all of you. Thank you for what you do. I really do believe, and I know many others do too, we would not have this great country without your sacrifice. Thank you so much. Folks, I'm very happy to be partnered with Four Sigmatic. It is a great company, and their mission is a simple one. Make the everyday magic of functional mushrooms more easily accessible to you, the consumer. And they do this by incorporating functional mushrooms and superfoods into products you'd use every day, such as coffees, hot cocos, elixirs, and easy-to-mix blends. Now, I'm going to give you, or they are going to give you, 15% off of their products. If you head over to cjevolution.com and click on the link, it'll take you over to peruse their fabulous products, and I would recommend them all. I know you're thinking mushroom coffee. Yes, it is delicious, and you're going to get 15% of all your purchases by using the promo code CJEVO. Survival. We've talked about it many times in the podcast. You read about it, you watch it on the news, you see it in movies. It is our nature to survive. That's what we do. That's what our primitive brain tells us to do most of the time. My next guest has been through a harrowing experience that happened in 1998, and she is a survival, and above all, even though she would disagree, and she does in this episode, she is a tremendously courageous woman. I had the pleasure of meeting her at the conference that I went to on leadership at the Air Force Academy in March, and you are going to love her message of survival and hope. I give you the one, the only, Brenda Tracy. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have Brenda Tracy on the show. Brenda, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you for being here, ma'am. I know you're very, very busy. I gave a brief bio in the intro. Can you fill in some of the blanks of who Brenda Tracy is?
Well, I'm a regular person. I'm a single mom. I'm a registered nurse. I'm an activist, an advocate. A regular person you'd see in the grocery store. But I'm also a rape survivor, and I do full-time work around these issues now, trying to kind of make people more aware, get people engaged, you know, do my part to end this type of violence.
And I had the honor, for all the listeners out there, the honor and privilege of seeing Brenda Tracy in person at the NCLS, which is the National Leadership Symposium down in Colorado Springs this year. Brenda, I believe it was in March, right, of 2018, and Brenda was one of the keynotes there. And her story is so powerful, and it's sad, but it's a story of survival. And I know it's a tough story to tell, Brenda, but can you tell your story?
Yeah, I'll just share real briefly what happened. In 1998, I was in my early 20s. I went with my best friend over to her boyfriend's apartment. And that evening, I believe I was drugged in my drink, and I was gang raped by four men. They were all college football players. Two of them went to Oregon State University. So I immediately reported the attack to the police. I got a rape kit done at the hospital, and all four men were arrested the very next morning. And I kind of thought that's when my episode of Law and Order would begin. You know, I had this idea, like, you really just, you know, you report a crime and the police arrest them, and then you go to court and the bad guy goes to jail and everybody lives happily ever after. But because two of the men were Oregon State football players, it became a media story just immediately. And the backlash started. People called me a liar and a slut and a whore. And why was I trying to ruin their lives and their football careers? And, you know, people just viciously turned on me. I started receiving death threats. It was pretty awful. Friends, family turned on me. And the DA told me I didn't have a good case at the time. The DA said, this is going to be he said, she said. It's going to be very difficult to prove. You're probably going to lose. And I was going to have to go through four separate trials, which I was told could take, you know, years. So given what the DA told me, I decided to drop the charges and not cooperate any further. I felt like I was making an informed decision. So then I kind of tried to just, you know, move on with my life. And over the next 16 years, I struggled. Depression, PTSD, I had a borderline eating disorder, just a lot of difficulties, a lot of the same difficulties that many, many survivors had. A lot of shame, a lot of silence, a lot of suicidal ideation, just really struggled. And then in 2014, I decided to come forward. I ended up through a series of events connecting with a reporter who decided to share my story publicly, and I put my name and my face on it. And this time, my community rallied around me this time. They believed me. But then an investigation was launched by the reporter who did my story, and we found out that the DA misled me. They had basically taped confessions from all four men. All of them admitted to varying degrees of crimes against me. And the police threw away my rape kit. They didn't test it. They actually threw all of my evidence away 3 years before the 6-year statute of limitations was up, and I was not notified. And it was all because at the time Oregon State University was trying to renovate their football stadium. And back then the DA, the police, and the university president would get together and talk about how to take care of football. And they decided that it wasn't going to be good for money donations and renovating the football stadium if people knew about what happened to me. So they did everything they could to just kind of make it go away. And it worked. A year later, a $5 million check was written by the Reeser family, and the football stadium was renovated.
it's ridiculous. And let me ask you this, Brenda. Was there any type of ramifications later on for the police misconduct, because that's what it was, as well as the DA? Was there any kind of fallout from that?
Not the way you would think. I mean, you know, as soon as I found all this information, the first thing I did is I went to a lawyer and I said, what can I do and who can I sue? I was very angry.
Of course.
And I was told by the lawyers I talked to, they said, well, there's really nothing you can do because DAs have immunity. They get to pick and choose what cases they take. And there were no laws on the books about, you know, evidence and rape kits and that kind of thing. So technically the police didn't do anything wrong. And I wasn't a student at Oregon State University, so those laws didn't protect me either. So basically, I was told there's nothing I could do about my case. But the lawyer said to me, you know, but if you wanted to help change a law, we would definitely help you do that. And so that's what I did. I 2 months later, I showed up at my capital in Salem, Oregon. And in 3 sessions, I've helped pass 7 laws in my state.
That's amazing.
One of them was extending the statute of limitations to prosecute rape. Another important one was a rape kit bill. So we have... We had a backlog of over 5,000 kits in my state. So police are now required to test all of those kits and all new kits coming in. And they have to keep evidence for at least 60 years and notify the victim. So basically the things that happened to me by law are not supposed to happen anymore in Oregon.
Well, it's just amazing to me because I know we're in different states. You're in Oregon and I'm in Colorado. And evidence tampering, because that's what it is. It's evidence tampering, destruction of evidence. That's a criminal offense. And it's been on the books here in Colorado for a number of years. I'm not sure exactly when, but I've been a cop for a long time now. And it's been on the books for a long time. And I know every state is different. And, yeah, it just amazes me that there wasn't any type of especially when all the fallout started coming, there's any kind of, you know, internal investigation or, you know, maybe possible criminal investigation. There wasn't any laws on the books. That's what amazes me, that to kind of keep law enforcement behavior in check, and especially when it comes to evidence tampering.
Well, and it's interesting, like you said, state to state, when you start getting into the weeds of it, there's a lot of things that we think are laws. Like the average citizen, like me, you just assume that must be a law. You know, and if somebody breaks it, then there must be some sort of, you know, consequence. But in a lot of ways, there's not. Yeah. It is kind of crazy. I mean, one of the laws that I helped pass was, in a criminal court proceeding for a rape victim, there's a rape shield law where you can't say, you know, what were you wearing, you know, past sexual history, that kind of thing. But there's not in civil cases. And so I just assumed that because there was one in criminal cases, there was one in civil cases, but there's not. So that was one of the ones we passed. But it's interesting when you really look into it, the things that we almost kind of take for granted of thinking our laws or we have rights, but then find out later after our rights are violated, oh, you didn't even have that right in the first place. So it's been a very interesting journey for me, learning all of this along the way.
And it's been a brave journey, and I want to talk about where you got your strength from. And I know you said, you know, you went through some counseling, a lot of counseling, but what amazes to me, because I've interviewed a lot of sexual assault victims over the years, not so many anymore based on my position, but the one thing, why would you, for the naysayers out there like you had to deal with, Brenda, why would you put yourself through a sexual, you know, rape kit? Why would you be making this up? And I'm sure you said that to people. Why would any woman, or anybody for that matter, because men can get raped too, but statistically women get raped more. Why would a woman go through that if she was making it up?
Right. Well, and we don't. You know, I think it's been shown that, you know, 2-8% of all reports are false, and some of those are just unfounded, which means you just really can't prove.
Yeah, can't prove it. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. Doesn't mean it didn't happen. It's just you can't prove it. Like you said, it's word against word sometimes.
So the real false accusations are very, very rare. It's very rare that a woman has consensual sex with a man and then literally gets up the next morning and says, I'm going to intentionally lie.
Yeah.
And say that this person did this. And that person obviously has some mental health or emotional issues going on. But I don't, you know, getting a rape kit is not a fun thing.
No.
And I firmly believe that for those of us who go to get a rape kit, it's very invasive. It's the very last thing you want to do after you've been raped. I think we do it because at some point, whether they're, you know, right then or a little later, we want to pursue justice. We want to make sure that evidence is there. Which is why the rape kit backlog is so upsetting to me. It's kind of like, you know, all these people, I think there's still 200,000 kits untested in this country. And it's kind of like, why would you put that a survivor through that, to go through that, have all that evidence taken, and then just take it and put it on a shelf and do nothing with it?
Yeah.
Like, what is that about? I don't understand it. It's awful and it's terrible.
So when you, and I remember hearing about, you know, hear about this in person when you were talking. So how did you, relationships were broken. You had close friends to you that were, you know, that no longer were your friends. I mean, how did you get past that, Brenda? Because you were isolated for a long time by yourself. I mean, how did you get the strength to carry on? Because a lot of people would give up, Brenda, and you travel around the world and you talk about this, and I'm sure you see a number of people that are suffering, and some of them, you know, hate to say, they probably don't make it through, whether it's taking their own life or whatever, their substance abuse issues and things like that. How did you get the courage to move on, or to not to move on, but to get the strength to, you know, go forward and do what you're doing today?
Well, I think if we go back to 1998, when I went on the way to the hospital to get my rape kit done, I think one of the really pivotal things that happened for me in that moment was, on the way to the hospital, I had decided to commit suicide. I just didn't see any reason to live anymore. But I was going to go get a rape kit for my mom. She was taking me, and it was kind of the last thing I was going to do.
Sure.
I had no intention of doing anything after that, but you know, I had a moment with God where I said out loud to him during the exam, why should I be here? And he said to me, I want you to become a nurse and take care of your sons. Because at that time, I was a single mom with two very small boys. And in that moment, I just had a purpose. And I think during the next 16 years, I definitely struggled. I did. But part of what kept me going was taking care of my sons. Sure. It was going to school and
purpose,
getting a degree. Yeah, I had a purpose. Yeah. I knew that I had a reason to be here. As hard as it was, but God did intervene on my behalf in that moment. But you know, it wasn't great, but it kept me busy, right? School and parenting kept me busy. And then in 2014, it was kind of like, you know, I'd done up pretty much everything with my career. My sons were grown. And then it was just kind of like, you know, are you just going to wake up every day wanting to die? And that was when I started deciding, you know, you have to deal with this. And so I started going to some counseling in a couple months. It was only a couple, maybe 2 months after I started going to counseling, maybe just a couple sessions after I actually started talking about my gang rape, that I ended up connecting with this journalist. And I really, people ask me today, how did you find the courage to share your story and to put your name and your face on it?
Sure.
But what I want people to know is that there really wasn't any courage involved in that moment for me. For me, that was really an act of pure desperation. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to wake up one day and not want to die. I just wanted to feel okay. I wanted to be happy. I wanted to have a life. And I just thought maybe if I share my story, maybe if I put my name on my face on it, maybe something will change. Mm-hmm. And, you know, God blessed me, and it did change.
But I
walked out of my prison of shame and silence.
But I think it does take courage, Brenda, because think of all the assault victims out there that don't do that, you know, that don't put themselves out, because then it's almost like, okay, if I put myself out there again, is it going to start over again? Are people going to doubt me? Are people going to ridicule me via social media? Because back in 1988, you know, we didn't have the social media we do now. Okay, am I going to open up this can of worms again? You know what I mean? In 2014, when you started dealing with this stuff again.
And I did think about that. I did think mm-hmm. about that, you know, and one of the things I thought about was like, well, okay, so in 1998, I got death threats and I survived it. Mm-hmm. I lost all my, you know, I lost family and friends. People turned on me. My community turned on me, but I survived it. So why couldn't I survive it again today? That was kind of, you know what I mean? For me, it was kind of like there wasn't really a downside at that moment for me. I was just so desperate for something else. But I definitely in that moment didn't feel courageous. And I suppose it's funny because I tell other survivors the same thing, right? Like they're always like, well, I don't feel courageous. I'm like, no, you're courageous.
No, you are courageous.
It's one of the stories you don't tell yourself.
Yeah. You're
so bad at that.
And I can tell you're a very humble person, but you, it is tremendous, you know, it is amazingly courageous what you did.
Well, thank
to get back out there and do it. Now, the one quick thing I want you to just, if you could touch on, Brenda, really quick, the Oregon head coach at the time.
Yeah.
In 1998, you told the story at NCLS, and there was a turnaround. There was kind of a complete change of what happened. Can you talk about that for a minute?
Yeah. So the two football players from Oregon State University at the time, Coach Mike Riley, who was most recently the head coach at Nebraska. Now he's back at Oregon State. But he was the head coach back then in 1998. And when the media interviewed him about his players being arrested and the charges being dropped and the whole thing, he said to the media, and his quote was, "These are good guys who just made a bad choice." Mm-hmm. And he gave him a one game suspension.
Jeez.
And I read about that in the news. And I was Jane Doe back then. So mm-hmm. I had no voice. I basically just had to take everything that everybody said and did. I was Jane Doe. So I read that and it hurt. I didn't understand how he was able to just minimize my life to virtually nothing. Mm-hmm. I mean, a bad choice is, you know, speeding and getting a ticket.
Exactly. Drunk.
Not gang rape.
Yeah, exactly.
So I carried those words with me all 16 years. I mean, mm-hmm. I stewed on them and mm-hmm. I was angry with him and I hated him. And then, you know, in 2014, one of the things I did prior to meeting, when I said there's a series of events that happened to me meeting that reporter, what happened was I was trying to figure out how to heal from this whole thing. I was in counseling. Mm-hmm. My counselor got sick and she left. And so I was trying to figure out, how am I going to find closure? And I thought about Coach Mike Riley. And so I thought about reaching out to him. He was at Oregon State in 2014, just happened to be down the street. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, maybe I'll talk to him. But I didn't know, in reality, what does that really look like, right? Do I show up at his office and I knock on the door? I'm like, hey, do you remember me? Mm-hmm. That was weird, right? So I thought, well, maybe I'll write him a letter and just explain to him how he made me feel and how he affected my life and my children, my family. So I started researching him on Google and just reading about him, and I just kept finding, you know, good stuff about him, how he's the best guy in football. And then I found an article that he had given a one-game suspension for a domestic violence conviction of one of his players, and I said, see, he's not a good guy. Mm-hmm. And I clicked on that reporter. Yeah. Not knowing who it was, and I sent this angry email about what happened to me and how much I hated Coach Mike Riley and what he said about me. And that reporter said, I'm proud of you. Do you want to talk? And I said, yeah, I do. And then that it turned out to be John Canzano, the lead sports writer here in Oregon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, John said to me, Brenda, if you just want to talk to Coach Mike Riley and sit down with him and try to find closure, I want to make that happen for you. I can make that happen for you because I want you to heal. But if you want to share your story, I'll write it. I think mm-hmm. you could help someone. And I was kind of like, John, who cares? Like, it happened a long time ago. Nobody's going to care. He's like, no, really. Like, if you want to do it, then I'll do it. And that's when I said, okay. Mm-hmm. And then Coach Mike Riley, as soon as the story ran, he apologized on the message boards, the story. He invited me to Oregon State to meet him and talk with his team. I didn't end up going, but then when he went to Nebraska, he continued to reach out to me mm-hmm. and invite me to Nebraska. And so I went summer of 2016, I went to Nebraska and I actually met Coach Mike Riley. I sat down with him an hour and a half. And then I talked to his football team.
And how did that go?
Now that took courage. I'll say that one took courage.
Yeah, well, it did, but you got some closure, right? I mean, to some degree, you got some closure.
I did.
And he apologized to you.
With him, yes. Yeah. With him, I did get closures. It's really amazing because Coach Mike Riley really held himself accountable to me and my pain. And I think this is a great lesson for everyone, right? Because sometimes we just hurt people. We mm-hmm. hurt them. And sometimes you just have to say sorry. Like, I'm sorry, and just put a period on it. Mm-hmm. Don't defend yourself. Don't make excuses.
Yeah,
don't
rationalize. I'm sorry.
Don't tell them why. Just say sorry mm-hmm. and hold yourself accountable to that person's pain. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what Coach Mike Riley did for me. And yeah. it was amazing for me. Yeah. I mean, it was a transformational moment for me. And yeah. him and I have actually become friends. I mean, I went from, like, hating this guy.
That's amazing.
To we're actually friends. And he calls, and we talk on the phone on a semi-regular basis mm-hmm. now. Yeah.
And that's a good point you made, Brenda, because, you know, and it just, yeah, I mean, sometimes I'm sorry is it's all you need to say, because the minute you throw yeah. in a but, well, then it's not, is it really an apology? I'm sorry, but here's the reason why I did the way. It's not
exactly.
an apology. It's not sincere.
Exactly. And I think we see it in so many industries, right? Mm-hmm. And with police, with hospital systems, with colleges, universities, how many times do we hear the legalese, you know, mm-hmm. the people refusing to apologize, even when they've been wrong because of lawsuits or whatever, like, you know, have the courage to just say, I'm sorry.
Exactly.
And say that that's not okay. We messed up and we're sorry.
And hold yourself accountable.
Really change. Yeah. And hold yourself accountable. I think it really could change a lot of things in our society if people would just do that.
Now, do you know, Brenda, just out of curiosity, do you know if anything has changed of the culture in that police department that initially, I mean, I don't know if you would, but because that's a culture thing, too. I mean, that tells me that there was some corruption going on within that police department. And I don't know if you know if anything has changed over in that department in the last.
I don't. I can say that, you know, when I was working on the law to do the mandatory rape kit testing, I could tell you that there was some pushback from the police in general in our state. Not a lot, but you could tell that they didn't want a law. But I was like, no, you need a law. Like, mm-hmm. you know, you didn't do your job. And this is the thing about the rape kit law, which I should say, which I'm not proud of for Oregon, but you know, we named our rape kit bill Melissa's Law. Mm-hmm. And when I started working on this with the lawyer I work with, Jackie Swanson, we knew that there was a backlog in Oregon because there was one in every state. We mm-hmm. just didn't know what it was. And so as we were going through different stories, that we found a story about a girl named Melissa Bittler. And she was a 14-year-old girl. She was snatched from a bus stop on her way to school. She was taken behind a house and she was raped and murdered. And when they were doing the investigation on her case, they looked at kind of the same MO. And they ended up finding previously, I think in 1987, some other girls, I think 12 years old, who mm-hmm. kind of the same thing had happened, but they weren't murdered. But what happened was when they tested those rape kits from back in 1997, it was the same perpetrator who mm-hmm. killed Melissa Bittler. So the question became, had you tested those kits, you know, would Melissa still be alive?
True. Yeah.
Now, when all this came out, they found out there was a backlog of over 1,000 kits mm-hmm. in Portland police custody at that time. And they told the Bittler family, we're sorry, we're going to test every kit from now on moving forward. And that was in 2001. And then mm-hmm. when I came forward, we found out, you know, 2015, there was 2,500 now in mm-hmm. Portland police custody. They had not been testing them. So for me, it was kind of like, no, you need a law.
Yeah, you need to get something.
You're not testing
yeah.
these kids. Like, yeah. are you kidding me? Like, this is an awful culture all over the mm-hmm. state.
Yeah.
So I don't know if the culture's changed. My hope is that the law is somehow helping the culture change, but I don't really know. I think there's still a lot of issues everywhere.
Well, I do too, but I do know technology's changing, you know, a lot.
Yeah.
When it comes to like DNA testing as well as other testing as far as fingerprint stuff, so it quickens it up, you know, it makes it quicker.
Yeah.
As far as the turnaround time, so.
And you have to make these crimes a priority, right?
Like, oh, exactly.
I mean, I mean, one of the complaints we were getting about this, you know, law going into effect is, what are we going to do about property crimes? And for me, it was kind of like, are you kidding me? You're asking me about property crimes?
Well,
we're talking about rape and sexual assault. Like, for me, it was just like, it was jarring for me.
Well, there's an order of importance. I mean, obviously, you know, crimes against people, obviously, assaults, sexual assaults, rapes. Those are the priority. Property crimes are all, you know, property crimes are secondary to crimes against persons. You know?
Yeah.
And they,
yeah.
And they should
be.
I mean, maybe other people have different views about that, but I've been a cop for a long time, and property crimes have always taken a back seat. Not that they're not important, but they've always taken a back seat to more serious crimes, such as sexual assault, you know, rape, things like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you were very instrumental in some legislation. What else are you doing now? I know you travel around. You're talking about survival. You're talking about rape prevention. Anything else you're doing out there?
Yeah, I mean, I spend a lot of time on the road traveling, speaking. I mostly speak on college campuses and mostly work with men. I've really decided that my target audience is men, and a lot of athletics, just because I think that there is a lot of power and influence within sports. And so I kind of want to work smarter and not harder. So I'm trying to kind of go right to the source. But I think that, you know, for me, though, I don't view men as the issue. I know it's easy to talk about men as the issue, right? Because they're the ones that are perpetrating the vast majority of this type of a crime. But I also know that women can't stop sexual violence. I mean, we've been trying to do it and we can't do it. So I know that men are the answer, right? So we really can't talk about men as a problem without also talking about them as a solution.
And I
so
think that's so important.
Pretty much what I do. It's vitally important.
It's
and it's interesting that so many people don't understand that concept. I literally, everywhere I go, I see light bulbs going off in people's heads. They're like, oh, she's right.
Yeah.
And I'm like,
yeah, well, you have
yeah,
to.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. And I remember that one of the things that was really moving to me, as well as you were in a packed room at the NCLS, and I'm sure you hear this all the time, Brenda. It's, yeah, when you said that, me and my partner were like, oh, my God. I mean, she's targeting men, which makes sense. But what was really moving to me personally is you and I know you know this, you're giving the courage to other women to come forward now, along with other movements out there, to come forward and say, look, I'm a victim, and, you know, you've given me courage. So, I mean, that's just amazing that you're, because you are very influential, and based on what you've gone through and your story of survival, and I'm so happy that other women now find the courage to come forward and talk about this.
Yeah, I'm really proud of what's happening in our society right now. I think that for so long, there's been so much silence around this, and we're even seeing men come forward now, which I think is amazing, because there's even been more silence and shame, I think, kind of, you know, because men aren't supposed to get raped, right?
No.
You know, it doesn't happen, it's hazing. So I'm just so proud of every survivor. And it's really, you know, sexual violence doesn't discriminate, right? It doesn't matter how much money you have or don't have.
And it's not just confined to sports. It's not just in sports. I mean, it's in everywhere.
It's everyone. Everyone and everywhere. Anyone can, literally anyone can be a victim. I talk to people about the fact, you know, animals can be victims of sexual violence. So if you're a human being, you can be the victim of sexual violence. It's an issue dealing with humanity.
Yeah. But it's changing, I think, at least one foot at a time. I think it's changing. And with the help of people like you to try to change the mindset, going out there, talking to, you know, men in particular about, look, this is wrong. You can't do this. And getting the word out there.
Yeah. Well, and even more than that, I think for me, I really don't, Here's what I know. It's about 10% of our male population committing these crimes, which means that 90% of our guys are good. They're not committing this crime. The problem is that they're silent.
Yeah, the good guys need to be.
They're inactive.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. They're not, and sometimes their silence and their inaction is complicit, right? Mm-hmm. They know something's going on. They're not saying anything or doing anything. Or you have the guy that's like, oh, well, I don't do that, so it's not my problem. That's the woman's issue. Well, those are the guys I want to talk to, right? Because those are the guys, the 90% that need to hold the 10% accountable.
Well, and it made me think about that. And I don't, you know, I read an article today about Matt Lauer at NBC and how, I don't know if you saw this in the news. And again, I don't want to go down this rabbit hole, but I think it proves your point about people remaining silent. So I read an article about how management didn't have any idea what Matt Lauer was doing. Really?
Wow.
And I'm not, I don't want to get onto a Matt Lauer bashing session, but I find it hard to believe that somebody could be at a place for so long with a lock on his door and not anybody know what's going on.
Couldn't he trigger the lock from his desk?
Well,
like,
I mean,
somebody had to approve to have that installed.
Well, great. And it goes back to your point, Brenda. And again, I just, you know, I mean, you mean to tell me that nobody, I guarantee you somebody in that organization knew what was going on. They just,
like you said,
they turned a blind eye and they remained silent because their ratings, they're making money.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I talk to my college athletes all the time and I ask the guys, I'm like, how many of you know the guy you wouldn't let your sister date?
And then they raise their hand.
And everybody raises their hand and they kind of giggle about it, but it's true, right? Like, and a lot of times it's like, oh, he's just like that, or stay away from him or whatever. But no. We have to start. Men have to start having conversations with each other. Mm. They have to start checking each other. Mm. The 90% needs to identify each other, and they need to start pushing back on the 10%,
exactly.
And shaming the 10% and saying, like, this is not okay.
Because,
like, we don't tolerate this. It is okay to respect women,
because
and that's what we're going to do.
Because the one thing that – another thing that really resonated with me when you were speaking, when I saw you in person, was not this – you know, some people have this, this view that all men are evil out there.
No.
Most men are good. You know, I mean, you said, but they need to start hammering the people, the 10% that are crap.
Yeah, they're just silent.
Yeah.
They're silent, and I think part of the thing too is that we have to, as women who've been doing this work for a long time, right? It's really about men aligning themselves with women,
mm-hmm.
and finding out, how can I help? What can I do? Because we'll let you know. We'll tell you. But we also have to invite men to the table too.
Exactly.
You know, and say, like, you know, we're going to do work on this together.
Mm-hmm.
I know that, you know, for me, when I talk about this issue, I know for women, it's frustrating, right? Because we've been dealing with this. We've been working on this for so many years. And it feels like men are stupid, right?
Yeah.
We're just like, oh, my God, how can you be
Well,
stupid?
We are kind of stupid.
And, you know, but that's unfair. I think that's unfair. And I think that we have to meet people where they're at.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that, you know, if this issue were math, this is an analogy I use a lot. If this issue were math, a lot of women are in calculus.
Yeah.
And a lot of our men are not. They're in, like, pre-algebra maybe at the most, or maybe they're just like learning to add and subtract. So you really can't expect them to perform in a calculus class, right?
Yeah.
So we really need to meet men where they're at,
mm-hmm.
and we need to stop being defensive, and we have to stop polarizing the issue and being divisive. And that's what I try to do. I try to go out and meet men where they're at and say, you know what, you may be adding and subtracting right now, but I need you in calculus. So let's talk.
I like that analogy.
And I'm going to tutor you, and then we're all going to go to calculus class together.
Now, what's on the horizon, Brenda? I mean, it sounds like, you know, you got a book in you. You got a lot of knowledge, a great story. I mean, have you ever thought about maybe a book?
I have, and I actually have someone who's kind of writing up the pitch proposal right now. And so hopefully somebody will buy it so we can get a book out there. But yeah, I do. And I'm excited about the book. The book is actually about the men in my life.
Yeah.
With the kind of the backdrop of my story. But one of the things I recognized about my story that I feel is really unique is that not only have men been a part of kind of the destruction of my life, but they've also been a huge part of my healing and my redemptive path.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a man wrote my story, and there was Coach Mike Riley, and there was President Ed Ray, and there's, you know, lawmakers. So I have all these coaches and athletes. I have all these really pivotal men in my life who have been part of my healing.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of women miss out on that. I think they've been hurt by men, but they've never had the opportunity to also heal at the hands of men.
Yeah.
And so I think that for me, the book is really going to be about, you know, men and their opportunity to harm or to heal.
Yeah.
And so I think it's an important discussion we should have.
That is an awesome, I mean, that sounds like a great book, and we'd love to have you back
Thank you. Discuss
the book when it comes out. You're always welcome back. Any final messages before we wrap up?
I would just say, if there's any survivors out there listening right now, please know that you did nothing wrong. It's not your fault. And you're not alone.
Mm-hmm.
You're not alone. You may feel alone, but, you know, there's social media. Make a fake account. Get on there. Reach out to other survivors
exactly.
if you need to, if you want to stay, you know, anonymous. But know that you're never alone, and you did nothing wrong.
And reach out to you, Brenda. How can people find you?
Yeah, so my handles on all my social media, Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook is BrendaTracy24. And then I have a website, BrendaTracy.com. There's an email on there. hello@brendatracy.com. People can reach out to me.
Well, Brenda Tracy, you're an amazing woman. You're a great survivor, and we love your story, and we wish you nothing
but
the success in the future. And when we hear about your book, let me know, and I'd love to have you back on.
Oh, I would love to come back on. Thank you so much.
All right, Brenda, take care.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.